Talk given Sunday, 6th July, 1980. There is a misconception, even amongst scholars, that the Buddha was not particularly concerned with society at large, that he did nothing for the sake of the millions of ordinary folk, that he was concerned entirely with those who became his members of his order, the bhikkhus, the almsmen, sometimes they are called, and he was not particularly concerned with the common folk. Now this is really a serious misconception. There is one long discourse called the Sigalovada Sutta, in which he speaks about society, the relationships between all members of any particular village or town, and he points out the way to right living and to fulfillment in this discourse of his. Long before the Buddha, when the Aryan immigrants into India established themselves, they brought with them various systems of ritual worship. One of these systems was concerned with what was called the worship of the various quarters of space, the directions of space, north, south, east, west, the nadir, that is the earth itself on which you stood, and the zenith. Now, each of these directions of space was said to be under the regency of one or other of the various Rig Vedic gods. And the worship was paid to the gods, and the prayers which the devotees offered were prayers for success in everyday life, in their business, for happiness, for well-being, for success, and for good luck, and of course, for success in battle. Now, it was a ceremony in which the devotee went to some sacred river or some such place, and he anointed himself with the water of that river, and there were the usual postures and genuflections and so forth. And the ritual worship was carried out in that way. Now, at one time, there were two lay followers of the Buddha, a man and his wife, who were very devoted to him and his teaching, and they were unhappy that they could not persuade their son, Sigala by name, to join with them. Sigala's excuse for not participating is given here. When they asked him to come and listen to the discourses, either of the Buddha or of the monks, he would say, "I'll have naught to do with Shramanas. Doing homage to them would make my back ache, my knees stiff. I should have to sit on the ground and soil and wear out my clothes. And when at the conversations with them, after so sitting, one gets to know them, one has to invite them and make presents, and so one only loses by it." Obviously, he must have been very, very young when he said that sort of thing. Finally, the father, on his deathbed, bethought him of a pious ruse. If he, an upasaka's son, that is, a lay follower's son, were daily to practice the worship of the quarters, the master or his disciples would be sure to see him and teach him better things. And since deathbed wishes are to be remembered, the son remembered and obeyed. To this day, that holds good in India, particularly throughout rural India. The deathbed wishes of a father are scrupulously carried out. So now, one day, when the Buddha was staying near the city of Rajagaha, one of the big cities of his time, he was residing in the bamboo grove at the squirrel's feeding ground. Sigala, rising early, went forth from Rajagaha. He lived in the town, of course, and with wet hair and garments and uplifted clasped hands, paid worship to the six quarters. The Buddha went to Rajagaha seeking alms. Seeing Sigala, he asked him why he did this worship. "My dying father said I should do so." "But," said the Buddha, "in the religion of an Aryan, the six quarters should not be worshipped thus." You notice that the Buddha uses the word Aryan, in the religion of an Aryan. An Aryan was a worthy one, a noble one. And there were, of course, two groups of people to whom that applied. The worthy one was the one who lived by the plough, who tilled the soil and earned his living without doing any harm to living creatures and so forth. That was one group. The other group, of course, was the warrior caste, the Kshatriya group, who included not only the warriors, but also the administrators and high officials in the realm. Those were the noble ones, the Rajanya, the ruling class. When the Buddha said this, Sigala said, "How then should the quarters be worshipped?" The Buddha says, "Inasmuch as the Aryan disciple has put away the four vices in conduct, does no evil actions from the four wrong motives, nor pursues the six channels for dissipating wealth, avoiding these 14 evil things, he is an encompasser of the six quarters." That is, an encompasser meaning that he is in right relationship with all the six quarters and he is carrying out a true worship. Then the Buddha proceeds to detail all the elements he's mentioned. The four vices, these are of course the same as the first four morality rules: to abstain from taking life, to abstain from taking what is not given, that is to say, to abstain from stealing, to abstain from all sensuous indulgences, and to abstain from lying speech. So those are the four vices: destruction of life, taking what is not given, sensuous indulgences, lying speech. The four wrong motives. And this is very interesting. Any actions which are done out of partiality, out of enmity, out of stupidity, out of fear, are wrong actions. Sometimes they are very evil actions. And so the disciple is enjoined to abstain from performing any actions from those four motives as such. Motive in this case meaning not one's intention, but the driving power, the motive power behind the action. The six dissipations of wealth. Now notice, the Buddha in this case is talking to a man of the world. And the man of the world is engaged in earning his living, in acquiring wealth and so forth. And so he talks in terms of the six dissipations of wealth. Addiction to intoxicants. Frequenting the streets at unseemly hours. Particularly, of course, prowling at night. Haunting pleasure resorts and fairs. Now, the modern world will find it rather amusing and difficult to swallow all this. Gambling. Evil companions and idleness. Now, these six dissipations of wealth are, as mentioned by the Buddha, were of course commonplace with the existing Brahmanical order. All these six come in the rules and regulations of the pre-Buddhistic Hindus. That is to say, the Brahman, the Vedic people. Now, he goes on to explain, intoxicants lead to loss of wealth, to quarrels and brawls, which is not untrue even today, to disease, to impaired intelligence. Prowling around at night means that the man himself and also therefore his family and his property are left unguarded, unprotected. The man who prowls about at night is suspected of crimes which he may not have committed. They are fathered onto him because he's a night prowler. False rumors are spread about him, and he meets with many troubles. Now, with regard to gambling, if he wins, then he begets envy and the hatred of those who have lost. If he loses, he bemoans his losses. His actual substance is wasted. He is despised by friends and by those in authority. This is rather an interesting point. His word has no weight in a court of law. The gambler's word is, the tendency is to discount what he says. He is not sought after in marriage since he cannot afford to keep a wife. Not sought after in marriage, not by some maiden, but by the parents of the maiden. They had arranged marriages, as you know, in those days, you see. And the parents chose suitable mates for their children, or at least they tried to choose them. And on the whole, in most cases, they succeeded fairly well, because the upbringing of children in those days, in several respects, was a very sensible and practical upbringing. To this day, you will find many of these things carried out, particularly in the rural parts of India. Then, regarding the perils of evil companions, any gambler, tippler, cheat, swindler, man of violence could become his friend and take him on the downward path. idleness. What should be done remains undone. What he has dwindles away, and he is reduced to poverty and deprivation. And idleness is described further in a way which sounds rather amusing to us. The man says, I am too hot and I cannot work. Or I am too cold and I cannot work. I am too hungry and I am not going to work. I am too full up and I am not going to work. Absurdities like that also occur. Now the Buddha distinguishes very clearly between false friends, who really are one's enemies, and true friends. He says, the friend who is ever seeking what he can take from you without making due recompense for what towards you, whose words are other than his deeds, who pleases you by flattering you, who is your companion down all the evil ways, he is a foe in the guise of a friend. The Buddha advises the wise one to avoid such people from afar as a path of peril and dread. Now, by contrast to such a man, the Buddha says that he who proves a comrade in your hour of need, him may you rightly call a friend indeed. We have a modern English saying, a friend in need is a friend indeed. The 25 centuries have passed by with that idea prevalent amongst civilized peoples. The true friend is your helper. He is the same to you in happiness and adversity. He gives you good counsel. He throbs for you with sympathy. Anukampako, that's the word used, which literally means one who vibrates because of what your condition is, vibrates in sympathy with you. He is one who lays down even his life for your sake. Now we have the same sort of teaching in St. John's Gospel, chapter 15, verse 13. No man hath greater love than this, than that he lay down his life for his friend. But 5 centuries before the birth of Christ, the Buddha said these words. He lays down even his life for your sake. To such a friend, you should devote yourself, even as a mother devotes herself to her bosom's child. Now this is one of the strongest modes of expression of love in India. It has always been so, it is to this day. The mother's love for the child is regarded as the strongest, the most powerful example of love. The good layman who is virtuous and intelligent and grows wealthy is advised to benefit his family and community by dividing it into 4 parts. One part to spend and enjoy for himself and his family. The second and the third part to invest in and conduct his business. And the fourth part to save and reserve for times of need, including occasions when help is needed by someone else or by the community as a whole, and so forth, for charity. Now, the worship of the 6 quarters, has 2 hymns in the Atharva Veda devoted to this matter. The Atharva Veda's date is approximately 1000 BC, so that it is at least about 5 centuries before the birth of the Buddha. And in the third book of the Atharva Veda, hymns 26 and 27 are devoted to this worship of the six quarters, as they are called. Each quarter has a regent or ruler assigned to it, one of the gods. The ruler of the east is Agni, the lord of fire. The ruler of the south is Indra. Indra was later on also called the lord of heaven. The ruler of the west, there are two rulers ascribed to the west, Varuna and Soma. Varuna is the moral governor of the universe. He is the first of the Rig Vedic gods. And Soma is the god of inspiration. Ordinarily, even great scholars seem to have made muddles in this matter. They have talked of Soma purely as a drink which was brewed out of the Soma plant, and if you drank this, it gave you visions and all that sort of thing. And a distinguished scholar of modern times has declared that Soma was none other than something like LSD, which is completely absurd, because in the Rig Veda itself it is distinctly stated that that which Brahmins know as Soma was never brewed out of any plant. Soma is the god of inspiration in the true sense of the word. Well, Varuna and Soma are the rulers of the west. The ruler of the nether is Vishnu. Vishnu later on, of course, becomes the second person of the Hindu Trinity. He is the lord of wisdom and the nourisher, the protector of man. And the ruler of the zenith is Brihaspati, the lord of prayer. Pati is lord or master or husband. Those are the three main meanings of the word Pati. And Brihaspati, the Brihats were the hymns, the mantras, the sacred hymns. And the lord of prayer is the lord of the zenith. Now you'll notice that in this hymn, the north is not mentioned. There are two gods ascribed to the west, but the north is not mentioned. Now I rather conjectured that the ruler of the north is Mitra, could have been Mitra, who works constantly in harmony with Varuna, the moral governor of the universe. And Mitra is the one who sees to it that all contracts between man and man are fulfilled. If a man has given his word to another, it is Mitra who sees to it that he fulfills, carries out his word. If he doesn't, Mitra punishes him. Also, Mitra is the lord of friends. We have the word Maitri, meaning friendship, affection which is friendship. And in the Pali, we have the word Metta. So, you will see in a moment why I suggest this. Now, the Buddha, with his usual, or I should say his extraordinary good sense and psychological insight, uses these six directions of space symbolically, and he assigns different things, in fact the whole of society, to the six directions of space. For the Buddha, parents are assigned to the east, and those who are interested in yoga know that the face and the front of the body represents the east. The right hand side will represent the south, the left hand side will represent the north, and the back of the body will represent the west. Parents are assigned to the east by the Buddha, teachers to the south. Now teachers in this case means the teachers in the ordinary sense, the school teachers, those who teach you the special art or craft in which you are interested, and so forth. Those teachers, they are assigned to the south. Wife and children to the west. West, behind the body. To this day in India, particularly in rural India, you will see my lord walking in front and wife and children following behind. Friends and companions, the Buddha assigns to the north. Now you see, because he assigns friends to the north, I suggest that perhaps Mitra was the ruler of the north in pre-Buddhistic times. And servants and employees are assigned to the Neda. Religious teachers and Brahmins are assigned to the Zenith. Now, the reciprocal relationships between different members of society who are all assigned in this this manner are very interestingly put by the Buddha. The one group ministers, the other group loves. Now, with the first one, a child should minister to his parents as the eastern quarter. And this constitutes the worship of the eastern quarter by the child. Now, he ministers in this wise. He says, once supported by them, I will now be their support. I will perform duties incumbent on them, which they are no longer able to perform in life when they are old. Therefore, I will carry out those duties on their behalf. I will keep up the lineage and tradition of my family. I will make myself worthy of my heritage. And in five ways, parents show their love to the child as follows. They restrain him from vice, they exhort him to virtue, they train him to a profession, they contract a suitable marriage for him, and in due time they hand over his inheritance. This handing over the inheritance was not only at the death of the parent, but on various other occasions. When the child, for instance, married, or there was some festive or other occasion for rejoicing, then part of the inheritance would be given to the child. Thus is the eastern quarter protected by him and made safe and secure. Notice the Buddha uses the word protected and not the word worshipped. To worship means to hold worthy, and this is the way parent and child hold worthy the eastern quarter. And he goes on, in five ways should pupils minister to their teachers at the, as the southern quarter. by rising from their seat in salutation, by waiting upon them, by eagerness to learn, by personal service, and by attention when receiving their teaching. In five ways, teachers show their love for the pupil. They train him in that wherein he has been well trained. They make him hold fast that which is well held. They thoroughly instruct him in the lore of every art. They speak well of him among his friends and companions. They provide for his safety in every quarter. In some respects, this teacher-pupil relationship and behavior is considerably different from our own times. Thus is this southern quarter protected. In five ways should a husband minister to his wife. Now this is very interesting. By respect, by courtesy, by faithfulness, by handing over authority to her, by providing her with adornment. By handing over authority to her. In India, right to this day, by and large, throughout the country, in the cities as well as in rural India, the wife is absolute mistress of the household. The husband also obeys the wife where the household is concerned. He is lord of the field. She doesn't interfere with him as the worker, as the breadwinner. And he doesn't interfere with her the way she manages the household. She is absolute mistress of the household. I know. And another very interesting point. This is right from Vedic times. The daily prayers which were offered in the course of a day were offered, were conducted equally, on equal terms, by husband and wife. There's no need for women to claim the privilege of becoming priests or priestesses or any such thing. It was taken for granted that they were complete equals, and all the ceremonies were carried out by them together as such. In five ways does the wife show love for her husband. Her duties are well performed by hospitality to the kin of both. This is a rule which is observed right to this day. The parents and relatives of the husband, as well as her own parents and relatives, they are tended to whenever they come a visiting or stay, or whenever they stay with them, and so forth. By faithfulness, by watching over the goods he brings, and by skill and industry in discharging all her business. Thus is the western quarter protected and made safe and secure. In five ways should a clansman, a member of society, minister to his friends and familiars as the southern quarter, by generosity, courtesy, and benevolence, by treating them as he treats himself. Love thy neighbor as thyself idea, and by feeling and by being as good as his word. In these five ways, friends and familiars show their love for him. They protect him when he is off his guard. And commentary of Buddha Ghosha explains this by giving as an example, supposing a man has some accident or falls on the road or something like that, a friend will stay by him and watch over him for his safety, see that no one comes and steals his clothes or money or anything like that, and they also see to the protection of his household. Friends and familiars come to their aid like that. And on such occasions guard his property. They become a refuge in danger. They do not forsake him in his troubles, and they show consideration for his family. Thus is the northern quarter protected. In five ways does an Aryan master or master not only of the household but an employer also in business minister to his servants and employees as the nadir, by assigning them work according to their strength and ability. It's a very interesting point. He has to judge just what they can do, and accordingly he will assign the work that they should do. By supplying them with food and wages. By tending them in sickness. Now I know that to this day, in the especially amongst the better off classes, the wealthier people, they do look after their servants very well indeed. When they are ill, they have them attended to by the doctor or sent to the hospital at their own expense, so that the servant is treated free of charge. By sharing with them unusual delicacies. Whenever there is some festive occasion in the family, a marriage or a birthday or something like that, and of course there is feasting, then all the special delicacies, the servants have their share and are asked to partake of them. I have seen this happen, actually. In my own home, this used to be done. By sharing with them unusual delicacies, by granting leave at times. They didn't have just 2 weeks or 3 weeks holiday for the year or anything like that, but whenever some occasion arose, such as a marriage or some unfortunate thing, the death of a member of the family of the servant, he was given leave to go. And I know that leave would last for several days, or sometimes it lasted several weeks. In these ways, servants and employees show their love for their master. They rise before him, that is early in the morning. They are up first. They lie down to rest after him. Of course, this is not always carried out. I know very well my mother and myself sometimes were up before the servants in the house. But once we were up, the servants would waste no time getting up themselves. They are content with what is given to them. They do their work well, and they carry about his praise and good fame. Thus is the nadir protected and made safe. In five ways should the clansmen minister to recluses and Brahmins as the zenith: by affection in act, affection in speech, affection in thought, by keeping open house to them, by supplying their temporal needs. And recluses and Brahmins show their love for the clansmen in six ways. Now, for the first time, you get six ways mentioned instead of the usual five ways. They restrain him from evil, they exhort him to good, they love him with kindly thoughts, they teach him what he has not heard, they correct and purify what he has heard, they reveal to him the way to heaven. Thus, the zenith is protected and made safe. Now, that's a very detailed description. It is the most detailed description in the Buddhist texts of the interrelationships between all the different members composing a society. Nothing, you will observe, nothing is mentioned regarding kings and ministers and official state officials and so forth. That comes in other texts. But this is especially devoted to the folk, society as a whole, as it existed in those days. Now, the standpoint taken in this code of domestic and other relations and the reciprocal duty resulting therefrom calls for one remark. Note that the parable of the six-quarter worship is carried out all through. Instead of worship, the only difference is that instead of the word worship, the Buddha uses the word protection. This is maintained right throughout. Just as good and loving gods take compassion upon their sincere devotees who wait upon them with material and spiritual offerings, so too, in all the six relations adduced, the seniors are represented functioning as little gods, the juniors or subordinates as devotees. The one exception may be in the case of friends equal in age and other respects. Now, the word used for compassion is anukampanti. This word, anukampanti, is the type word for the protecting tenderness of the stronger for the weaker and means vibrating along after. That is to say, the feeling of compassion does not end with the actual situation or the event in time. It continues onwards. You will notice that the word compassion, kampanti, our word compassion is derived from that root. Thus, in emotional force, it is even stronger than our English compassion or sympathy. And because the pulsing emotion is other regarding, a feeling together, whatever the loved one feels, it is justifiable to render it often by love and not just by compassion, love having a deeper significance, thus taking the smaller concept up into the greater. The Buddha frequently claims to feel this godlike emotion when he says, hitanukampa sambuddho ayad anyang anusasati, which means love and compassion doth the enlightened feel towards another whom he teaches.